Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we will look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an examination of what may be behind the recent meeting between Jared Kushner and the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, after which a dozen Saudi princesses were arrested and at least one has been killed in the name of stamping out corruption. At the same time, the Prime Minister of Lebanon resigns from office in Saudi Arabia, and Iranian missiles are fired from Yemen at the Saudi capital. Dov Sakheim, a former Undersecretary of Defense and Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Defense, joins us to discuss his article at Foreign Policy, Jared Kushner, Mohammed bin Salman, and Benjamin Netanyahu are up to something. Then we'll examine the denial about Russian involvement in the U.S. election that rejects the consensus of all U.S. intelligence agencies found both on the political right and the left and propagated by polar opposite news outlets such as Fox News and Breitbart and The Nation. Mark Lowenthal, president of the Intelligence and Security Academy, who served as assistant director for analysis and production at the CIA and vice chairman for evaluation on the National Intelligence Council, joins us to discuss the consternation among intelligence professionals that the head of the CIA, at Trump's urging, met with a former NSA official who advocates a conspiracy theory that a U.S. intelligence insider hacked the DNC, not the Russians. Then finally, we'll look into President Trump's trip to China, where the Chinese leader is giving him the imperial treatment of pomp and ceremony and flattery, using an old Chinese strategy of treating Trump with great respect, but giving him nothing. One of the world's foremost experts on China, Perry Link, the editor of the Tiananmen Papers, who was blacklisted by the Chinese government in 1996, joins us to discuss the futility of trying to get the Chinese to pull America's irons out of the fire. And joining us now from China is Dov Sakheim, who is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who from 2001 to 2004 was Undersecretary of Defense and Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Defense. Yes, his latest article at Foreign Policy is Jared Kushner, Mohammed bin Salman, and Benjamin Netanyahu are up to something. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dov Sakheim.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And you, of course, are in China, but your article is about another theater, and many people think that there is a possibility of a war with North Korea, or even a nuclear war. But it looks like the proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran is heating up.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. In fact, the Saudis have said that what just happened with the missile hitting Riyadh was, in fact, an act of war. That was the term that the foreign minister, Abdel Al-Jaber, actually used. So it certainly is heating up. Probably the Iranians did not fire the missile. The Houthi rebels fired the missile, but it's clearly an Iranian missile, and there's no doubt that the Iranians have been supporting the Houthis for quite some time.
So let's go to the meeting then. We know that Jared Kushner was in Saudi Arabia. The meeting was announced only a week ago Saturday when he returned. I believe he went with his brother who runs the real estate company. But supposedly he's forged a kind of generational bond with Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, the 32-year-old crown prince who, for all intents and purposes, seems to run not just Saudi Arabia. He's running so many portfolios. It's almost like Jared has so many portfolios too. So,
they do seem to have something in common. Jared's about 37, and the Crown Prince is 32. So clearly, it's a lot easier for them to talk than for either of them to talk, either to President Trump, who's over 70. Or King Salman, who's over 80. So, yes, they clearly have some kind of relationship. Apparently, on this visit, Jared Kushner and the Crown Prince stayed up talking till the wee hours of the morning. There's no doubt that there is a relationship there, and I speculated that, particularly given President Trump's rather positive response to what the Saudis had said after the attack and also what Crown Prince Salman had done arresting these princes and businessmen, including the fabulously wealthy Prince Saud, Donald Trump said, yeah, that was a good thing. It's not a crazy assumption that perhaps the president was tipped off by Jared Kushner, who discussed this with the crown prince. It just seems more than just a coincidence.
Well, is there also possibly a connection here, given that Jared Kushner and his father and the family are longtime family friends of Benjamin Netanyahu? Apparently, when Netanyahu stayed with the family, the Kushner family in New Jersey, Jared would have to give up his bedroom for Netanyahu. So the extent to which he's supposedly an emissary between the Israelis and the Palestinians, is he in fact an emissary between Netanyahu and the Saudis?
He may well play a part. You know, there's been this rumor that the Saudis have denied, but that seems to be all over Israel, that the crown prince, who's defense minister among his many other jobs, actually visited the Israeli defense ministry at Kiryat. Nobody knows if that's the case, but the Israelis have been very coy about the relationship with the moderate Gulf Arabs. There's constant statements coming out of Jerusalem to the effect that you know, relations with the moderate Sunni Arabs are better and better, and this kind of sort of nudge-nudge, wink-wink type of talk tells me, of course, that and everyone else, that there is some relationship under the table. So given that that exists, and given that Jared Kushner is very welcome in Israel as well as in Saudi Arabia, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that he, in some way, it may be passing key messages or acting as an intermediary in some other respect.
But what then do you make of the peculiar exit of the Lebanese prime minister, who earlier MBS had basically taken away his money because, you know, his father is a Saudi citizen, a former president who was blown up by Hezbollah. And then he sort of restored him, and then he shows up in on Al Arabiya in Saudi to announce his resignation as Lebanon's prime minister. And the speculation is within Lebanon itself that he may well have almost been kidnapped. So something peculiar is going on there. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, he was seen on television. I saw him on television with King Salman. So clearly he's not exactly in chains or locked up somewhere. You know, his father was a Saudi citizen. His father was quite close to the Saudi regime. He was bumped off literally by the Syrians and in cahoots with Hezbollah. You know that the Saudis do consider Hezbollah a terrorist organization. And Hezbollah represents the sort of western end of what King Abdullah of Jordan called the Shia Crescent. You've got Iran, you've got Iraq, you've got Syria, you've got Lebanon, Hezbollah, all in the Iranian Shia orbit. Now you have Yemen in the south. The Saudis have always been very concerned about what's going on in Bahrain, where the Shia are clearly restive, and you do have Saudi police across the causeway from the eastern province of Saudi Arabia who have been sent into Bahrain, and the eastern province itself is very heavily Shia, to the point where some people will even go so far as to say you really shouldn't walk around there at night if you're not Shia. That may be an exaggeration, but it gives you a sense of what the Sunnis feel about the Shia threat to them. And so it's maybe not all that surprising that given the very tenuous situation in Lebanon, given Hezbollah's active involvement in Syria, and it's punching so far, maybe not even above its weight, maybe just has the weight in Lebanon, that the Saudis finally said enough is enough.
Well, but what about the Israelis? I mean, if indeed, and it appears to be the case, that the Shia Crescent has become a reality where Iran will have a land corridor from Tehran through to Damascus and through to Beirut, doesn't that impact Israeli security? And is what we're seeing now some kind of precursor for a bigger confrontation?
Well, it certainly could lead to that. The Israelis have been very cautious. They've essentially said that they will intercept anything that is going to Hezbollah from Iran via Syria. And they've done that. And they'll never acknowledge bombing facilities in Syria, but they continue to do that. They bomb shipments, and they seem to be very good at finding those shipments. I think the Israelis will probably continue to restrict themselves to that for as long as they can. I think if the Iranians went further than that, the Israelis would respond in a violent way. Now, that does not mean that the Israelis may not help the Saudis and others surreptitiously with military advice. You can't rule that out. I mean, after all said and done, look how closely they're working now with the Egyptians and the Sinai. And they've worked for many years closely with the Jordanians. It's been an open secret. Maybe this is what's going on now, that maybe for the very first time, the relationships will go beyond maybe secret talks to some form of training, advice. After all, the Israelis are very good at that, and the Saudis could use the help.
Well, just back to your article, Jared Kushner, Mohammed bin Salman, and Benjamin Netanyahu up to something. The fact that so many of these wealthy princes have had their fortunes confiscated in the name of attacking corruption, which is pretty much the way the royal family operates, as far as I know, it's all rather, Aramco has been a slush fund. It's hard to believe that. If you take Aramco public, as Donald Trump has urged, that's going to shed some transparency there, I would think. But how much is there a kind of, the fact that, for example, Alawid bin Talal had been a fierce critic of Donald Trump's, and now he's toast, if you will. Is there a personal angle to this with Jared and his father-in-law and the Saudis? Not to mention.
Well, there's always a personal. Well, people are people, and so there's always going to be a personal angle in everything. I think that. Look, I'm here in China, and Xi Jinping is clearly extremely powerful, and he has managed a major anti-corruption campaign, which seems to be actually succeeding. And so you can have two things going on at the same time. That is to say, you could go after those who are corrupt, and they happen to be people that are rivals. And so it may well be that the crown prince is seen what Xi Jinping has been doing quite successfully and decided he'll take a leaf out of the same book.
Well, it is an extraordinary triumvirate here, Jared Kushner, Mohammed bin Salman, and Benjamin Netanyahu. And there does appear to be a kind of de facto alliance developing between Israel and Saudi Arabia. So maybe that's what Jared Kushner is going to get credit for, not an Israeli-Palestinian peace, which seems pretty remote at this point.
Well, I think that's right. The Israelis and the Palestinians are basically frozen right now. And my guess is that you're not going to see any real movement. And a lot of people agree with me on this until both Abu Mazen, who is the president of the Palestinian Authority, and Prime Minister Netanyahu leave the scene. Neither of them is indicating they want to leave the scene anytime soon, which means that any kind of movement toward a two-state solution, which I personally happen to support, would not happen for a while. On the other hand, I think that you may be right, that if Israel gets closer to Saudi Arabia than it already has been, that'll go to the Trump administration's credit, although I must say that the person who really brought Israel and the moderate Arabs together was Mr. Obama, because neither of them trusted us.
Well, Dov Sakam, I thank you very much for joining us here.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dov Sakam, who is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who from 2001 to 2004 was Undersecretary of Defense and Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Defense. And his latest article at Foreign Policy is Jared Kushner, Mohammed bin Salman, and Benjamin Netanyahu are up to something. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the consternation among intelligence professionals that the head of the CIA, at Trump's urging, met with a former NSA official who advocates a conspiracy theory that a U.S. intelligence insider hacked the DNC, not the Russians.
Absolutely. Let's get sad again. Whoa.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mark Lowenthal, who's president of the Intelligence and Security Academy and a professor at the Johns Hopkins University. He served as assistant director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production, vice chairman for evaluation at the National Intelligence Council, deputy assistant secretary of state for intelligence, and staff director on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. And Dr. Lowenthal is the author of the Standard College Graduate School Textbook on Intelligence, Intelligence from Secrets to Policy, now in its sixth edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Lowenthal.
Thank you, Ian.
And as an intelligence professional, did you ever think that the very question of intelligence would be so critical to the politics of the moment and as we are going forward with this Russia investigation? Because you've got the Russians and a number of people in the United States on both the left and the right not believing what the consensus is of the 16 intelligence communities. So how did we get to a situation where conservative right-wing cold warriors are making excuses for Putin and left-wing Americans like Oliver Stone and the editors of The Nation magazine are also making excuses for Putin? And basically they're either on the right, they're saying it's fake news, as the president says, or on the left, they're saying it's people trying to gin up a new Cold War. So at the center are the 16 intelligence communities. So what are they doing wrong that people don't believe them?
Well, I don't, with all respect, I don't think they're doing something wrong. And the question you ask is good. I really don't understand, especially on the Republican right, this sudden bromance with Vladimir Putin. He's not any nicer than the Soviet leadership, except he doesn't run a gulag. And to watch right-of-center Republicans suddenly falling over themselves to praise Vladimir Putin, I mean, the spinning noise you hear in the background is Ronald Reagan turning over in his grave at this. And so it's totally inexplicable. So how the intelligence community got here, first of all, I'll tell you, this is a place the intelligence community does not like to be. They do not want to be dragged into partisan political arguments. It is not their job. It is not their role. They see themselves as being neutral, just like the military. So this makes them extremely uncomfortable, is the only way to describe it. The way they got dragged into this was they were doing their job. They reported in January that Putin had done things to affect the outcome of the election. Now, they never said he affected the outcome. That's not what the January assessment said. But they said, based on a lot of the intelligence they were seeing, that this had happened, that there were, and clearly it had happened. I mean, we had the testimony last week from Google and Twitter and Facebook, where, you know, Facebook said, well, 146 million people saw Russian ads. So to deny that it happened at this point is a bit silly, because the tech companies are admitting that they were either victims or witting agents for this. But the politics of it is a different issue in terms of where people are coming from. As you said, on the right, it's you're questioning legitimacy of the president's win, which is not what they're doing. And on the left, it's just the age-old suspicion of intelligence activities, which is something that goes back deep into our history.
Well, is that the kind of vestiges then of the Church Committee? Because, you know, obviously there was some substance to the Church Committee.
Oh, yes, there was tremendous substance to the Church Committee. The Church Committee and the Pike Committee, which happened at the same time, nobody remembers Perotus Pike, found that the agencies had done things that were either, as I always tell my students, A, illegal, or B, stupid, or C, all of the above. And so they did that. I mean, but you have to understand that, and this is a point that you have to make over and over again, the intelligence community does not have an independent existence. It exists to serve and to do what policymakers ask it to do. The CIA didn't wake up one morning and say, you know, we ought to kill Fidel Castro. The Kennedy brothers, both of them, Robert and John, wanted Castro killed, and the CIA said, okay, sir, we'll get on it, which obviously they weren't very successful. Obviously, he died in his bed. So they're not a bunch of, you know, remember, Frank Church said at one point it was a rogue elephant. What people don't remember is he later withdrew that comment. and said, no, they're operating under orders. They are not a rogue elephant. So that's how they work. Even when they get things wrong, it's because, and sometimes they just say no. You know, we can't, and the rules of what they can and can't do have gotten more strict. Like assassination is completely off the books these days. And so, but they work for policymakers.
Well, that's, of course, always been the great irony, that the American people, and particularly on the left, think that the CIA is the source of all evil in the world,
right.
And anything and everything that they've done has been on the orders of the executive branch. And the intelligence, particularly the CIA, has always been the favorite toy of the executive branch. So I always find that extraordinary, that all the presidents
yes.
who use and abuse the CIA get off, whereas the CIA gets blamed.
And the CIA, to be honest about this, the CIA was the last place I worked in the government. The CIA prides itself on the fact that it is the president's intelligence agency. DIA was for the Defense Department, the state's intelligence bureau was for the State Department, you know, and so on and so on and so forth. But the CIA takes a tremendous amount of pride, rightfully and sometimes to excess. We are the president's agency. And so having this close, intimate relationship with the president matters to them. That's their only function, really. They don't have, you know, they don't have to, they're not supporting all these other actors in a department. They are a free, independent agency, and they work for the president. But they also, that means they respond to the president. Now, I will tell you that, when, for example, if you're sitting in the room and they're discussing doing something operational, I think you'd be surprised, and I hope heartwarmed, at the number of times that the people who are going to be responsible for carrying this out or for directing it will look down the table at the lawyers and say, are you sure we can do this? Are you absolutely sure we can do this? Have you no doubt in your mind that this is legal? Because they don't want to go out there and do things that are illegal and that are going to get them and the country into trouble.
And again,
you have to see this happen in the room when it's happening to sort of say, gee, this is pretty good.
Right. Well, I suspect it's happening quite a lot with a more activist president that we have now. But that leads me to, let me again remind the audience, by the way, I'm speaking with Mark Lowenthal, president of the Intelligence Security Academy and a professor at Johns Hopkins University. He served as the assistant director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production, vice chairman for evaluation at the National Intelligence Council, deputy assistant secretary of state for intelligence, and staff director at the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. And he's the author of the Standard College Graduate School Textbook on Intelligence, Intelligence from Secrets to Policy, now in its sixth edition. And the reason I called you, Mark, was because The Interceptor reporting that a month ago, mm-hmm. the CIA Director Mike Pompeo, at the urging of President Donald Trump, met with a former National Security Agency employee, William Binney, who I've interviewed in the past, who has basically a conspiracy theory. He's a denier of the Russian interference in the U.S. elections. And I understand that the very fact that the head of the CIA, as you say, the president's intelligence agency, and obviously he's done this because the president asked him to do it, met with Binney on the seventh floor at the CIA, and this has upset the rank and file.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're hearing? I mean,
yes. I mean, the problem is, you know, when the president asked the director of Central Intelligence Agency, I don't care which president, which director, to do something or to meet with someone, it is very, very difficult to say no. Or to say, well, look, I don't think this is appropriate. Can my deputy meet with him? And I think, especially in the case of Donald Trump, it's probably even more difficult to say no because of the nature of his personality. I mean, some presidents might listen, might change their mind, but I don't see Donald Trump as one of those people. So Pompeo had the meeting with Binney. Binney, as you said, is a former NSA officer. He was accused incorrectly of being part of a major leak at NSA. He was not the leaker, but he was confronted by the FBI under some fairly bad circumstances, which is what I think what turned him into a critic. And the trouble is, first of all, it looks bad for Pompeo that he's allowing partisan politics to get dragged into the agency, which nobody at the agency wants. I'm not even sure that he wants. And it does affect the rank and file. You know, they wonder, you know, who is this guy? What's he doing? Why is he having meetings with Bill Binney about the Russian investigation? Now, Pompeo did say that he still backed the intelligence community assessment in January that said that the Russians interfered. But the fact of the meeting is very problematic in terms of Pompeo's relationship with people on the Hill, certainly with the Democrats on the intelligence committees, and it's very problematic in terms of his own workforce.
Well, just in context of what we were talking about earlier, the denial on the right about Russia's involvement and the denial on the left about Russia's involvement seems to be at play here, because Benny has been frequently on RT and also on Breitbart and Fox.
Yes.
Supporting this idea that this whole thing is an inside job, that there was somehow within the intelligence community, they were the ones who actually hacked the DNC,
right.
Not the Russians.
This is daft. This is up there with people who refuse to believe we landed on the moon. I mean, you're always going to find, America is a wonderful place for conspiracy theories of all sorts. And some of them are really seamy, and I'm not going to tick them off right now. But no, I know the people who were responsible for the intelligence community assessment. I've known Jim Clapper very, very well for, 23 years. They would not make this up. What's the upside of their making this up? To say to Donald Trump, we don't like you? That's kind of stupid, because whether you like him or not, whether you voted for him or not, he's the only president you have. And you want access to the president. You want the president to listen to your intelligence seriously. And there would be no upside in trying to tick him off by writing a spurious report. It just doesn't make sense as to what would be the motive for doing this. And I see no basis for it other than the mindset of Bill Binney and the mindset of people on the far right who just want to somehow slough this off. But, you know, when you have Google, or Alphabet as they are now, Alphabet and Twitter and Facebook sitting there and saying, yes, this happened to us. Are they part of the conspiracy also? Really? It doesn't make sense, Ian. It just doesn't. And it's very dispiriting as a citizen. It's very dispiriting for the intelligence community. Because Pompeo saying on the morning, yes, I believe the assessment, but I had this meeting with this guy. And he has the meeting. Now what happens? Or does he just tell Trump, well, I had the meeting. You happy now?
So what's going on here then? Because the group, Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS, I've interviewed a lot of their members, Ray McGovern and Thomas Drake and Benny in the past, and Phil Giraldi. By the way, almost all of them, in fact, like all of them, are regulars on RT, on the Russia Today. But you mentioned Benny being mistreated by the NSA and by the FBI, and that may have influenced him. The memo that he authored for VIPS argues that the DNC emails were not taken by Russian hackers, but were instead downloaded on a thumb drive by somebody inside the U.S. intelligence services. In other words, stolen by an insider. Some of the members of VIPS, including Thomas Drake, have dissented from that view. Mm-hmm. But what's going on there with this group of intelligence officers who are going against the grain? I mean, I find it troubling that anybody goes on RT, let alone watches it. But what's your attitude?
Well, in Binney's case, the turning point was this accusation that he was part of Drake's leak to this Wall Street Journal, which turns out he wasn't, but he had access to the information. In his case, and Ray McGovern's case, it was the Iraq estimate on WMD. I have debated the Iraq estimate and how it came about and what it was about publicly with Ray McGovern. And, you know, he really doesn't want to be disturbed by the facts. They have a model in their head now of what the intelligence community does, and they force-feed the facts into that model. It's just, there was a quote from a British admiral in World War I. He said to his staff, I don't give a damn about the facts. You can't dispute the evidence. And I sort of feel like that's the conversation you have with these people. They just have decided that it's all dark, it's conspiratorial, the intelligence community. Now, it's funny because they're on both sides of the argument. In the case of Iraq, their accusation is we wrote the estimate for the president so the president could go to war, none of which is true. I was actually the person who received the facts from the Senate asking for the estimate. I know exactly how it was written. I know exactly why it was written. But now, so that's one stance. But when we get to this Russia thing, it's that they were doing this, I mean, not for the president, but they were just rogues. They just want to believe that the intelligence community is just completely operating on its own. And they know better. They really do know better. And it's hard to explain. You know, they're apostates, and apostates, like any other fanatic, they're fanatical. That's the only way I can describe it to you. I don't think they're cynical. I don't think they're doing this for fun. I think they believe it, but I don't think there's a shred of intelligence that would actually support their allegations.
Well, I have spoken with Lawrence Wilkerson, who was in on those meetings with the Secretary of State, and in the conference room with the DCI tenant before the UN speech, and they were clearly troubled by it. And I spoke also with Tyler Drumheller, who had just before that. He'd said that he told the DCI tenant that one of the sources for the
curveball
was a fraud.
But it didn't all, you know, I remember when Tyler wrote that, and Tyler has since passed away,
right.
And a bunch of us who saw that all looked at us and said, what does he have to do with this? He wasn't involved in this.
Right.
I mean, he was an EUR clan services guy. The briefing for Powell, it was based on the intelligence we wrote in the estimate. The estimate was wrong. I'm not arguing about that. It was wrong for a bunch of interesting intellectual reasons. But we wrote the estimate for the Senate. We didn't write it for George Bush. We didn't write it for Dick Cheney. We didn't write it for Don Rumsfeld. They knew they wanted to go to war. They clearly wanted to go to war. But they didn't need us, the intelligence community, to bribe them with a rationale. They had a rationale. The request, as I said, came from the Senate. And this request said very specifically, we want this in 3 weeks before we decide on whether or not to vote to go to war. And we wrote the estimate. Now, we made a bunch of interesting intellectual mistakes in the estimate. But the estimate also did not affect the Senate, Ian. The Senate has 100 members. Six of them read the estimate. Six, which we made them sign for it. It's highly classified. Maybe another 12 were briefed on it by staff. 77 of them voted to authorize the use of force, which means at least 59 senators voted to go to war but never actually had any contact with the intelligence. And then, you know, Colin Powell goes to the UN, gives his presentation, which turns out not to be true, and he was very sore about that. And I understand that. But the UN didn't vote for us either. The UN did not authorize the use of force, so we went to war without them. So the interesting thing about the estimate is that, yes, it was wrong, but it didn't actually influence anybody's decisions. There's an irony here, but McGovern really doesn't want to have this conversation. He insists that we wrote this for George Bush. We didn't. We didn't write it for Cheney. As I said, I was actually the senior officer in CIA on the Sunday afternoon when the facts came in. So I know this to the depths of my soul.
So at the end of the day, what does this say? That it tells me the enormous power that presidents have and
yes.
The difficult job that people like you have convincing them of the facts.
No, well, first of all, if it's facts, we're not going to argue about it. The problem is we're arguing about things that aren't facts, you know, maybes. We're arguing about possibly, maybe, perhaps. Clearly, the president has a lot of power. The president runs the executive branch. It's his part of the government. And if the president, and there's nothing to prevent the policymaker from ignoring, disregarding, or refuting your intelligence. They are allowed to do that. We are not speaking ex cathedra. We do not have sort of, you know, holy writ. We're giving them our best case of what we think is going on or where we think an issue is going. And if presidents want to disregard that, if secretaries want to disregard that, they can and they will. So it, in that sense, it's a difficult job. But if you know what your role is, your function is in the national security process, you accept this and you can push back. I mean, you have to be polite, you have to be deferential, but you can push back if you think they're making a mistake. But at the end of the day, it's their call. I emphasize this to my classes over and over and over again. It's their call. which they're the ones who are going to have to execute the policy. And one last point, intelligence officers do not make policy recommendations. So if you're the intel officer and I'm the secretary and I say, Ian, we got A, B, and C here, which one should we do? You're not going to tell me. You're not going to give me your answer, because the thing you value, among many other things, is your objectivity. And if you give a policy recommendation, say, you tell me, oh, sir, it's option A, you're going to make sure that all your intelligence from then on out shows me how brilliant you were when you said A, and you have lost all your objectivity. So we come right up to the policy line, but we never go absolutely near it or across it. I describe it to my students as the third rail. And so we have an advisory job. We do not have a policy job. That's the policymakers. So you have to accept, you know, where you are in the rank order of things. And most intelligence officers understand that. Most heads of the CIA understand that. But then you get moments like this where the president leans on you, in the case of Mike Pompeo, and it puts him in a very difficult situation. There's no good answer to this. When he can't say no. He can't say, can the deputy see it? So he has to sort of swallow and do it and then hope it doesn't cause a lot of damage elsewhere down the line. It's not an enviable position to be in for him.
Well, Mark Lowenthal, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome, Ian. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Lowenthal. He's president of the Intelligence and Security Academy and a professor at Johns Hopkins University. He served as assistant director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production, vice chairman for evaluation at the National Intelligence Council, deputy assistant secretary of state for intelligence, and staff director of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. And Dr. Lowenthal is the author of the Standard College Graduate School Textbook on Intelligence, Intelligence from Secrets to Policy, now in its sixth edition. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into President Trump's trip to China, where the Chinese leader is giving him the imperial treatment in a strategy to treat Trump with great respect, but give him nothing.
Beware of pretty faces that you find. A pretty face can hide an evil mind. Oh, be careful what you say. Away. Odds are you won't live to see tomorrow. Secret Asian man, secret
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Perry Link, who holds a chancellorial chair in innovative teaching across disciplines and is also a professor of comparative literature and foreign languages at the University of California, Riverside. He's one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, and people, and has translated many Chinese stories, writings, and poems into English. In the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform student protests in June of 1989. He was blacklisted by the Chinese government in 1996. Welcome to Background Briefing, Perry Link.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, thank you, Perry. And President Trump is in China, in Beijing, in the Forbidden City, where he's getting the imperial treatment. I think the Chinese realized how much mileage the Saudis got out of lavishing him with praise and pomp and circumstance. It does seem that President Trump is uniquely vulnerable to flattery. What do you think the flattery will get the Chinese in the case of Donald Trump?
I think it'll be pretty effective. I am not an expert on Trump, but I agree with your observation that he's clearly vulnerable to flattery. And on the Chinese side, this is a long tradition in China of bringing foreigners to the imperial capital. And the Forbidden City that you just referred to, we must remember, is right at the heart of the heart of the heart, not only of the communist regime, but of imperial dynasties before it. So it is the quintessential place at which to to bamboozle a visitor. So I think that will happen.
And in terms of an American capitalist mogul and a Chinese communist supreme leader, what's the chemistry there? Because even though China is nominally very, very capitalist, obviously they learned from the collapse of the Soviet Union that glasnost is a bad idea. In other words, liberalizing speech, etc. Whereas perestroika, there's no limit. So what's your sense of the way we're talking about imperial dynasties? It does seem that Xi wants to set himself up as not so much leader for life, but at least into the near future.
Yes, into the farther future than the Chinese law at present would have him last. He's supposed to step down after 5 more years, but there are clear signs that he's angling to stay longer. I'm not sure he models himself on emperors, indirectly perhaps, but mainly on Mao Zedong. At the recent high-level Chinese Communist meeting where he bolstered his position and prestige, he got the phrase Xi Jinping thought into the Chinese constitution. The only other person who has that phrase is Mao Zedong with Mao Zedong thought. So I think that's where he is. To call him now communist and the regime communist is a bit misleading. I mean, 30 years ago that applied. Now it is hell-bent for leather capitalist. And the prominent families, including the Xi family, control industry and communications and make money hand over fist. There was an expose of the Xi family in particular by the New York Times about 3 years ago that is, of course, not told about in China, and it's hushed up and repressed as much as possible. But these guys are they're like late 19th century American capitalists in how they unscrupulously just get as much big money as they can. So in that sense, they're similar to Donald Trump. They're fish of the same feather, I mean, fowl of the same feather there. Where they're different is that Trump is clearly a political neophyte, not only in our country, but even worse, internationally. He plainly just doesn't quite know what he's doing, and his only advantage, I suppose, is his unpredictability. Whereas Xi Jinping, from the time of the Cultural Revolution, when he was sent to the countryside for punishment, quote-unquote, he's learned the ropes. He's the son of one of Mao Zedong's comrades, and that gave him a sort of halo to start with. But then he's learned how to do skullduggery and sycophancy in order to get to the top of that kind of closed system. And he's extremely good at that kind of political manipulation that I think, you know, compared to Trump, Trump is just a babe in the woods compared to that kind of skill.
Well, I think an added disadvantage the U.S. has with this leadership is that there are so many mixed signals and nobody's really in charge of foreign policy. At least Tillerson doesn't seem to be. The UN rep seems to have as much say as he does, Nikki Haley, and Jared Kushner, the son-in-law, has all kinds of portfolios, including China. And he's even more of a neophyte, as far as I can tell, than his father-in-law. And then on top of that, you have Trump saying one thing and tweeting out another. So the Chinese must be a little confused. On the other hand, maybe this gives them certain advantages.
I think it does. I think underneath they're probably pleased that Trump is confused and seems confused because that leaves them more elbow room for manipulating. Of course, anyone has to worry about where the next tweet is going to go. At that level, it might be unnerving. But in terms of showing what a neophyte he is compared to the clever long-term calculations that Xi Jinping has in mind, must make them feel more confident that their long-term projects are going to get the upper hand.
Well, I'd like to talk to you about those long-term projects, Perry Link. So just to sum up what we've been talking about, what Xi Jinping is going to give China is, and this is what their strategy appears to be, is to treat Trump with enormous pomp and circumstances and respect and flattery, but to give him absolutely nothing. So let's talk about the difference here in terms of Trump's first act was to tear up the TPP, which was more than a trade agreement. It was an effort to organize the neighborhood concerned about Chinese expansion and motives into a pact that would force China to play by international rules except their own rules. Trump has been an enormous gift to them in the sense that now they can start writing the rules, and they've made that clear that they want to be a major power. They're also building pipelines, roads, and rail right across to the Indian Ocean in Pakistan, bypassing the entire American Navy in terms of the sea lanes of communications in the Straits of Malacca, etc. So you can see that they do have a strategy there. Myanmar, for example, where the U.S. was starting to make inroads and peel away some Chinese support that the previous Burmese government had, that seems to have been reversed because of Trump. In general, looking at the broader picture, would you say that China is winning in terms of hegemony and the U.S. is losing? Or in other words, is China a rising power and the U.S. a fading power?
Well, I think it's a little more complicated than just putting it that way. Certainly the effort to spread not only to Pakistan and the One Belt, One Road reaches all the way towards Europe, and then the Chinese presence in Africa in a number of countries to extract minerals and resources is very prominent as well. But how long and how strong that can be is subject to a couple of questions in my view. One is that they appear in places like Africa and perhaps in Myanmar too as a new version of colonialism. They're coming in extracting resources, not necessarily with the best interests of the local people in mind. The Chinese expansion to the world has no echo of a policy of human rights. It's just not theirs. You go into the country, deal with its own ruler, whatever kind of ruler it is doesn't matter, and you make deals, and you build roads, and you extract resources, and that's that. The other big vulnerability is in the regime itself. For all of its growth and all of its increased power, both economic and now military and diplomatic, there's an insecurity inside the regime in China. The most dramatic evidence of this, which we continually get but don't notice, is how much money and people from the privileged elite in China leaks abroad. Here in L.A., there are certain communities where Chinese money, probably corrupt money, that is, from the wealthy class that wants to park its money overseas, does so and sends its mistresses and students and children. The number of Chinese students who come to the U.S. is way, way bigger than the number of American students that go in the other direction. That's too bad in my view. I wish I could get more American students to go to China. But this is evidence, I think, of an insecurity in the regime. Even the people who are benefiting from it underneath don't feel fully confident that it will be able to last.
Well, it's pretty clear. When you mentioned, by the way, China likes to make deals and they sort of have a kind of colonial attitude to extract resources and make deals with the government, no matter how corrupt it is.
Yeah.
I think Trump is moving in that direction as well, abandoning human rights and other moral stands that the United States has taken over the decades in terms of its foreign policy.
Yes,
but just on the point
sure.
that you made, though, you know, there, for example, there's a huge new building in Century City in Los Angeles that's almost entirely empty because it's all of the luxury condominiums have been bought up by Chinese in exactly the way that you're talking about. These are the children and mistresses of the elites who, by the way, get a green card if you invest $500,000. That was what Jared Kushner's sister was trying to do, sell green cards in exchange for investments into the Kushner properties in New Jersey. So that is an indication that they're hedging their bets. How does that impact then Xi and company? I mean, the implication there is that either, one, they don't trust the government and maybe their money will be confiscated like what's happening now in Saudi Arabia, or two, do they think the system's going to collapse? What's the motive for hedging your bets and having both U.S. green cards and investments over here?
It's to keep the money safe, for one. Xi Jinping has pursued his anti-corruption campaign now for 4 or 5 years that targets local officials when they're excessive in their banqueting and so on, but at the higher level targets his political enemies and uses the corruption charges to bring them down. And I think if you're high in the system and a potential rival, seen as a rival of Xi and his group, you're always worried about that as well. So what money you have while you have it, you know, park it in Australia or Vancouver or Los Angeles. I think at a more significant level, too, all the other rhetoric notwithstanding, there's a sense that education and media in the outside world are something to take advantage of. Here, the sending of young people abroad to students, not only to the U.S., but to the U.K. and Canada and Australia, is a clear sign of that. We have here at UC Riverside, I'm teaching currently a number of courses that have students from mainland China in it, and almost invariably they are wealthy. They can get on an airplane and go back to Shanghai for spring break and things like that, and they drive Lexuses and so on. But they're not brain dead. Some of them are smart, and some of them are benefiting from an open, unfettered education and know that they are. And I think that their parents back in China know that that's the case and would just as soon have their children go to a liberal university as to, you know, mind training in a Chinese one.
But are they materialistic and nationalistic, or are they political and broad-minded? Because, as you know, only too well, since you've been blacklisted by the Chinese Communist government because of translating the editing the Tiananmen papers, that after Tiananmen, the Chinese elite government, the Politburo, decided the best way to curtail the democratic aspirations of young Chinese was to encourage nationalism and materialism.
Right, right. That's for sure true. I guess my point is that human psychology is complex and layered. Just the other day, a Chinese student, clearly a wealthy background student, came to my office and he asked, "Is it true that the students died at Tiananmen?" You know, because really it was the students who killed the soldiers, right? And I said, no, that's upside down, basically, to the truth. And here's a book to read about it. And I took from my shelf the original Chinese version of the Tiananmen papers from which my friend Andy Nathan and I edited the English version. And I lent it to him. And he said, sure, I'll borrow it. And he went away. And we haven't had a good talk about it yet, but it was clear that his eyes opened when that happened. You mean this could be true? And then when we were talking about officials in China in connection with some of the stories we were reading, it was clear that he had complaints in his stomach about how officials treat people. Even though his father is a Communist Party member and he does work in an official capacity. So for sure, what you just mentioned, the materialism and the sort of narrow nationalism that the media and the schools have pushed in China for the last couple of decades has taken a toll. So that you get young people like this young man who haven't even heard of the true story of the massacre in 89. But underneath, other things happen. And I think that's another reason indirectly why people in China want to hedge their bets abroad.
Well, just in closing, the other issue, of course, that Trump has brought with him is some expectation that China will get America's irons out of the fire with North Korea. That's always been a futile hope on our part. There's no love lost between the North Koreans and the Chinese, particularly Xi Jinping. He can't stand Kim Jong-un. What do you expect is going to happen there?
I expect nothing will happen there. This standoff has been there for now since the late 80s. The U.S. State Department on this issue has handled the Chinese government with kid gloves because of the expectation that they could do something with their sanctions and so on. But they haven't. And I think here again you have an example of a long-term vision on the Chinese side that can manipulate the U.S. side, which is more short-term and more fickle. So they just stay in the background and says, yes, we might help, we might help. They never really help, but they never really say they're not going to help. They enjoy the position of being looked to for help and want to propagate that very tradition. I don't think that anything can come of that. I think Trump is terribly naive to have a dinner with Xi Jinping in Florida and say, I like this man, we see eye to eye, and he's going to help us in North Korea. Xi Jinping underneath is chuckling at, oh, we caught another fish here. We have this guy expecting that we're going to do something. China has cut back on export of some energy materials to North Korea, which is very important. But in food, which is also very important, they've increased it massively since last year. You know, dozens of times more imports of food from China are coming into North Korea than last year. So this is playing two sides and just waiting and enjoying the ambiguity, as far as I can see. I don't think Trump will get anything on that score.
I thank you for joining us here today, Perry Link.
My pleasure.
And again, I'm speaking with Perry Link, who holds a chancellorial chair in innovating teaching across disciplines and is also a professor of comparative literature and foreign languages at the University of California, Riverside. He's one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, and people, and has translated many Chinese stories, writings, and poems into English. And in the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform student protests in June of 1989. And he was blacklisted by the Chinese government in 1996. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.